This week we've got Harry McCracken. He's the founder of the Technologizer, plus David Cohen, Guy Searle, and me, Tim Robertson, My Mac Magazine podcast number 194.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com podcast.
And we're back for another exciting week of Apple and Macintosh news. But of course, we're not just focusing on that this week. We've got a special guest. Harry McCracken is joining us along with Guy Searle. Hello, Guy Searle.
Hey, Tim.
David Cohen from the UK.
Hello, hello.
And Harry, how are you doing, Harry?
I'm doing well, and it's great to be here.
And we really want to thank you for being on our show this week. We've all heard you on the TWiT podcast. And I was asking you before, are you going to start your own podcast? Because personally, I think you really should. You've got a great voice, and I think you could lend a lot to podcasting. So it might be something you might want to consider in the future.
It's definitely on my to-do list, and it's nice to gain some experience by being on podcasts like this one.
So let's talk about the Technologizer website. This is a brand new website. When did you launch this?
You know, it's really been only the last 2 weeks that I've kind of been in soft launch mode. I actually have a lot of things which I haven't launched yet, but I began posting content regularly just 2 weeks ago, and I'm getting it rolling.
So for those who don't know your name, because obviously we have a lot of Macintosh fanatics that listen to this show, they may not be real familiar with the name Harry McCracken. Although you did kind of make some waves about a year ago when it comes to Apple and the Macintosh and all that, and a lot of Mac websites were surprisingly in your corner for kind of a faux pas on PC World side. So let's start with that, and then we'll kind of work forward to the future and what you're going to be doing and what you're doing now. So you were the editor-in-chief of PC World, correct?
Yeah, most of the experience I have doing technology journalism I got at PC World because I worked there for 13 and a half years. First, of course, doing a magazine, and then in recent years doing a website and a magazine.
So how do you look at the industry as a whole? I mean, you're kind of on the inside as far as you're based in San Francisco. You're the editor-in-chief. At least for 4 years of PC World. I believe you were an associate editor before that for, like, what, 10?
Yeah, I had various other jobs for the first 10 years, and then I headed up the content operations for the last 4 years.
So you're somewhat of an insider, but not really, because you're a journalist. How do you view what's been happening in the computer industry in the last, say, 15 years? Where do you see it going, and has it kind of progressed the way you thought it would?
Well, I stayed at PC World as long as I did because it was the industry constantly changed. The media business is constantly changing, and so it never got boring. And certainly one of the big changes is PC World is 25 years old, and when the magazine started, it was about a box on a desktop. And then for the longest time, people really associated PC World with Windows, and a lot of people assumed that all we did was Windows computers, and they were kind of startled when they saw us cover the Mac, or when they saw that my notebooks tended to be Macs for the last few years.
Well, they also made good PCs, though, too.
Absolutely, and right now my primary computer is a MacBook Pro, on which I run both Mac stuff and Windows stuff. And because I'm not at PC World, hopefully nobody will think that's strange anymore.
Well, how do you run Windows on your Mac?
I have both Bootcamp and Parallels. Obviously, there are some situations where you want your Mac to be as close to just being a vanilla PC as it can be, and for that, Bootcamp is still cool. And then other times, you just want to run one Windows application. I think that Office 2007 for Windows is better than Office on the Mac, and so I sometimes just load that up.
We've talked about that ourselves. David Cohen, his fenestration, Windows, having a Mac in a Windows world that appears at My Mac Magazine's website. David, you talk about running Windows 2007 rather than Office 2007 rather than 2008 all the time.
Yeah, I'd definitely agree with you, Harry. I mean, Office 2007 is a fantastic suite of software. Unfortunately, the Macintosh version is lagging severely behind, in my view.
They really are just basically different products that share a name and certain features.
Yeah.
Well, why do you think that Office on the Mac has lagged?
One of the things I always thought was in some ways kind of cool about the Mac business group at Microsoft is it looks like they genuinely are allowed to kind of do their own thing and do what they think is best. Clearly, in the Windows world, this product is a huge cash cow and is just about as important as Windows is in terms of Microsoft making money, and it's also widely used in business. And with the Mac, clearly it's not anywhere near as big a deal in terms of being core to the company, and it's not quite as corporate, and I think that has some effect on what they decide to do. It's actually true that in terms of the org chart at Microsoft, Office for the Mac has no relation to Office for the PC. It's run by a different group altogether. And my sense is maybe they honestly kind of are doing their own thing in the way they think is best, although I really like the interface on the Windows version and wish they had done that with the Mac version.
With your position at PC World, I'm sure you got to meet a lot of the higher-ups at all these technology companies. Who are some of the favorite people that you met that you were just really amazed that they were completely different than the way you thought that they would be?
Good question. I'm trying to think of some of the heroes I've had that I've met. One of them is Vint Cerf, who actually goes back to 1969 and truly is one of the people who invented the Internet. He's at Google now. He's a wonderful guy. He's just still, deeply involved in where the web is going and is both an impressive person and a nice person. There's Marc Andreessen, who, was the co-inventor of Netscape Navigator and the whole idea of graphical browsing. He's now starting a site called Ning, which I'm actually using for Technologizer because it lets anybody set up an online community. And in Internet years, he goes back a long time.
Yeah, definitely.
But he's still a young guy, and he's not resting on his laurels, and I think it's possible that someday people will remember things like Ning just as much as they do Netscape.
It's kind of hard to come out with a 2.0 product that has nothing to do with the 1.0 product. I mean, as big as Mozilla was and Netscape is or was, do you really think his next product is going to be that big?
We'll see. I mean, it's hard to top the idea of coming up with the graphical browser, but I think Ning is awfully clever and awfully neat. But it certainly is true that second acts are rarely as big as first acts are in this business.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's your take on online apps versus apps that are just on your computer?
Well, that's one of the things I'm most interested in, and I'm using a lot of them. And in fact, a lot of the time when I do Office Suite type stuff, I'm doing it in Google Docs. But there still is something to be said for the reliability of knowing something is on your hard drive. I tried to use Gmail today, which is where I do a lot of my email, and it was down. And Google Calendar occasionally goes down. And clearly, in terms of volume of features, none of them are anywhere near as fully evolved as desktop suites.
Well, and do you think – well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I don't think any of them sort of have every single feature you'd want them to have, although there's some value, I think, in starting from scratch and not adding on 25 years' worth of functionality.
Yeah, I think cloud computing is probably the future, but I don't think it's the present so much, only because – you're in San Francisco, so you're going to have a lot more opportunity to be online outside the house than anybody in Kansas or here in Michigan. But it's just we don't have that coverage of Internet access throughout the United States or the world yet. That's going to be the biggest hindrance to, I think, cloud computing. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, until you can assume Wi-Fi everywhere, it can't be a full substitute. Until Wi-Fi is on every plane, there are going to be big issues. There are people doing interesting things with providing offline access to online apps. Google has something called Gears that lets you continue to use online apps when you don't have a connection. There's a company called Zoho, which does a really neat online suite that competes with Google Docs, and you can use that when you're offline, but you lose some of the functionality, and it's not terribly satisfying.
Yeah. And it's starting to get to the point where these applications are very, very much platform independent. Do you think that's going to cause a lot of problems for either Microsoft or Apple in the future, that it really doesn't matter what computer you're using?
I think so. I think that's a huge change. And in the old days, if you were considering whether to go Mac or PC, you needed to think about major applications. And you still do to some extent, but I think the browser is really the platform for most of the interesting things that are happening today. And I think that's one reason why Microsoft has struggled a little bit with Vista, because most of the fun things people are doing, they're doing in online applications. They're not doing it in the operating system. And Apple has done a pretty good job overall of keeping Leopard relevant. But one of the interesting things about looking at all the stuff that happened with Mobile Me mm-hmm. is that all that experience Apple has with doing the best desktop applications in the world doesn't mean that they're going to get online stuff right.
Yeah, they're not transitioning to the cloud computing very well.
I think Mobile Me still has an awful lot of promise, but it's clear that it's really complex and really hard to do well.
Any other tech pioneers that you were surprised to meet and very impressed with?
Yeah, let me think. Those are the two that leap to mind immediately. I also got to meet Douglas Engelbart, who really invented the graphical user interface in the 60s and invented the mouse.
The mouse. I met him at the last Macworld Expo briefly outside the South Hall Moscone.
One of the interesting things about this whole world of personal technology is it really goes only back about 30 to 40 years, and we still are in a period where most of the important people are still with us, and that's going to be less and less true over time. But it's fun to get to meet some of my heroes.
Do you think the tech guys nowadays are going to become the rock stars of the future? I mean, everyone knows who Mick Jagger is, but not everybody knows who, say, Kevin Rose is, who's kind of a tech rock star nowadays. Do you think they're ever going to have that popularity in mainstream media that the rock stars have?
I mean, I have to keep reminding myself that living in San Francisco, I really am in kind of a bubble.
Yeah.
And that people who we assume that everybody know are not all that well known in the rest of the country. And in fact, if you list the tech people who are household names after you name Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, it's hard
That's
to think of it. More.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was watching, what's her name? Kathy Griffith, My Life on the D-List. And I stopped there because it had Steve Wozniak on it. And I thought, oh, cool, Steve Wozniak, and it's a bear convention, which is big, hairy, gay guys, and that's kind of what Steve Jobs, or Steve Wozniak is. He's kind of a big guy, and he's kind of hairy, and I thought, well, I wouldn't have put him in this show it kind of messed with my mind, but then I thought, but he's a celebrity, whether we think about him that way or not, and I'm wondering if the rest of the world... or at least American culture, starting to catch up with the fact that these people who created these products, whether it's software or hardware, are starting to become the new rock stars. So I was curious on what Harry had to think. What do you think about that, David? Do you think that tech guys are going to become rock stars?
I think certain people can rise to the top and can become very well known. I mean, here in the UK, probably the two guys who, sort of tech guys who are well known in sort of our media is a guy called Sir Clive Sinclair, who created the very first home computers that were set for sale here in the UK. And he's known as kind of like an inventor and he's known as a boffin, really, as a sort of bright entrepreneurial inventor. And then there's the other one is James Dyson, who created the cyclone vacuum cleaner.
The Dyson Sphere? That's Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
Right.
No, but he created the vacuum cleaner that kind of doesn't need a bag. It spins all the dirt out of the air. And they're very well known over here. And he's well known as a tech innovator in our industry. But outside of that, I think probably there's quite a lot of people who aren't well known outside of tech circles.
So you're at... Go ahead.
I think it's fascinating that both Steve Jobs and Bill Gates go back to the mid-1970s, and they're still kind of the two best-known guys after all that time, and even though there are a lot of people who are reasonably well-known, none of them are household names in the way those two guys are.
Why do you think those two are, though?
I think in their own way they're both incredibly compelling personalities. The contrast between them are so striking in terms of what they look like and sound like and what they're good at. They created the two most important companies up until now, although Google is so tremendously important. And, if you go out, if you parachute into almost any American city and find people at random, they will know Google, but they can't name who the founders of Google are in the way that they might bring up Steve Jobs and Bill Gates.
Now, do you think, though, that if Google went out of business tomorrow, Do you think that would have a bigger impact than if either Microsoft or Apple did?
You know, I guess one way to look at it is today most people get to Google on a computer that either runs an operating system from Apple or Microsoft.
So yeah,
right.
At this point in time, the computers are still really core to the experience. I think looking forward, the web is going to be more important to your computing life than the platform you happen to get to it from. And 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, when people think about personal technology, it's quite possible they may mention Google before they mention either Apple or Microsoft, but we're not there yet.
Are you surprised that the whole media explosion and technology kind of came together when they did and how they did? Was that kind of at PC World, did that kind of surprise you?
Yeah, I mean, when I started at PC World in 1994, I actually worked on the special edition we did called PC World Lotus Edition, which had this big section on 1, 2, 3, and computers were really still very kind of business-centric back then, and spreadsheets and word processors were the biggest stories. And it was fascinating to watch entertainment and computing kind of merge and see music and video and most other things in our lives that entertain ourselves become the same topic as computing, and everything become kind of digital. And one of the fascinating things is, I mean, the story has not all been told there.
No.
Music is almost completely digital now. Movies are a little bit there, but it's clear there's a long...
Well, it's coming.
I think that's more of a bandwidth issue, don't you agree?
That's the single biggest thing, although I don't think anybody has come up with a device for watching movies, which is as pleasing an experience as an iPod is for music yet.
I'd agree with that, definitely.
Yeah. Do you think we're spoiled nowadays, Harry? I mean, you think about 10 years ago, the sort of things we had on our desks and, you know, connecting to the internet as was done over telephone lines was fairly slow. And now we have computers that effectively are supercomputers from 10, 15 years ago in terms of what they can do. And we've, you know, most people have got access to broadband or Wi-Fi of some description that's much higher speed than the dial-up connection. Do you think... I mean, sometimes I find all of that is quite amazing, considering what computers are like when I first got into them. And, you know, do you think people appreciate how far we've come in such a short time?
It's kind of astonishing, and I'm also kind of struck by how quickly phones have evolved and what my iPhone 3G can do compared to the phone I had even 3 or 4 years ago. I'm also struck by the fact that... computers are giving us access to information in a way that is so profoundly valuable and so different from the past. When I was a little kid, I was interested in old radio shows, and you'd have to kind of scrounge to find any example of an old radio show, and you'd get it on cassette tape, and you'd probably pay $5 or $10 for 1 or 2 episodes, and they were hard to find. And today, at the Internet Archive, you know, you can download every show Jack Benny did.
Yeah.
Free in one place and listen to it in a very convenient way. And
I was a big fan of I Love a Mystery.
Mm-hmm. So we're getting access to all this great stuff that in the past would have been very hard to find, and now we have it at our fingertips, and oftentimes we have it for free.
We know we have this World Wide Web, so we have pretty much instant access to a wealth of information, and yet it seems to me most Americans, at least, keep going to these entertainment type of websites to get the latest gossip. And so even though we have a great repository for knowledge, I think people are getting dumber. Do you agree with that? Or?
I mean, whenever a new communications medium comes out, people at first say this is going to be fantastic as an educational tool. That was certainly true of TV. Back in the late 40s, people thought that Americans would become smarter because of TV, and that didn't happen. And the web, you know, the web is what the web is. I think ultimately communications methods are kind of neutral, and people will do with them what they do. But if you are interested in becoming smarter, the web is an incredible tool. And I feel like I'm smarter because now I have Google on my phone, and when I'm curious about something, I can pretty easily get an answer, and rather than making a mental note to myself to go to the library and look it up in an encyclopedia.
So you recently quit, formally quit PC World, but you had quit before that too. What's the story about 10 things we hate about Apple, and what was the whole story behind that?
So if I told you the whole story, we'd be here for about 2 hours.
Give us the cliff notes.
If you Google for me, you'll find lots of information on it. But the very short version is, you know, I've been in this business since the early 90s, and I've been very proud of the fact that not once did I ever change a story to please an advertiser or to punish somebody who wasn't advertising. And that's really important because I think there are a lot of people out there who assume that the computer magazines and technology websites are in bed with their advertisers, and that's so not true that I've always felt you had to bend over backwards to not be that way. And the very short version is I had a new boss a year ago, and we were working on a story called 10 Things We Hate About Apple, and he got kind of concerned about it and its implications to the business, and he told me not to run it, and I walked over that because, you know,
you have standards.
You can't lose your virginity and get it back and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And amazingly enough, things worked out, so I came back after about a week.
Were you surprised that they went your way?
I was kind of startled that the whole thing was as big a deal as it was. I mean, I love blogs. I love the blogosphere, but I was probably a little naive about the extent to which an interesting story can be everywhere and can be debated and people can take sides.
I got to say, I was 100% on your side. As a Mac publisher myself, as an independent publisher, I'm very much of the mind that advertising and content on the website itself are two separate entities and one will never interfere with the other. So when you walked, I was like, ready to go, Harry. And to be honest, up to that point, I really wasn't that familiar with PC World other than skimming through it once a month. Because, you know, as an Apple guy, I didn't really care about what was going on with Dell and Compaq and those companies. And there was, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of Apple content up to about maybe 2 years ago. It really started turning around, I think. But when you quit over this, I was 100% in your corner, and I didn't blame you a bit, but I was kind of surprised at how many Macintosh-focused websites came out in your defense as well. I thought that was fantastic. Even though the article was 10 Things We Hate About Apple, you wanted it published, it was pulled, everybody seemed to be in your corner. Did that surprise you too?
A little bit. I mean, one thing which some people reported, but not everybody, was from the get-go when we were planning that article, we were planning another article called 10 Things We Love About Apple. So it was not about PC World being an organization that hated Apple. It was about PC World, you know, being passionate about technology and having strong feelings pro and con. And I think I have to say there's almost nobody out there in technology who feels so strongly about the stuff they use as Apple fans, and anybody who covers Apple knows that sometimes if you criticize Apple, you will catch a lot of flack. I think ultimately, you know, even the biggest Apple fans understand that there are wonderful things about Macs and there are things that are kind of annoying, and it's worth talking about both of them. And I do think that partially because a lot of people have a sneaking suspicion that technology magazines and websites are on the take, you know, people were kind of glad to see somebody saying, saying, I'm not going to be on the take. I'm not going to let the business decisions affect what I do. And PC World is published by a wonderful company, which I've worked for most of my professional career, called International Data Group, which really has a wonderful reputation for letting editors be editors. And so I have to say, in the long run, I wasn't completely surprised that things worked out okay, because IDG is the kind of company that understands that if you don't have readers who trust you, you're not going to have a business for very long, because you won't have readers, or you'll have readers who won't pay attention to the advertising either.
So did this story have any kind of effect on you deciding to become a self-publisher yourself and the Technologizer website launched? I mean, did one have to do with the other one at all, or you were just ready to leave IDG and PC World and kind of strike out on your own?
You know, not particularly. Like I say, I'd worked for a large organization for a long time and for the most part had a lot of fun and was really loved my coworkers and was proud of what we did. But I had done it for a long time. I kind of thought it might be time to scare myself a little bit. One of the amazing things about the web, and yet another wonderful thing about the web, is it lets somebody create content and get it online with very little expense. And if you can do something that somebody wants to read, you can get it out there. and the web is mature enough as an advertising platform that you don't have to be a large traditional media company to do content and have advertising pay the bills. And there are wonderful tools like WordPress that let you publish very efficiently. And also, as wonderful as PC World was, when you're the editor-in-chief of a large magazine, you spend an awful lot of your time in meetings about things like budgets, and you spend less time actually touching interesting products and thinking about them and writing and communicating with the outside world. And that's the most fun of all. And I thought to myself that if I launched my own site, I could come back to that and do more of that. And so that was my thinking, and I wanted to leave PC World kind of on a high note while I was still having fun. I felt like I had accomplished a lot, and I also felt like my colleagues there were more than capable of doing a good job, whether or not I was there. And PC World was wonderfully successful before I got there and will be very successful without me. And I thought it was an interesting challenge to try to build a brand from scratch.
We're talking to Harry McCracken. He is the founder of The Technologizer. What's the present and what's the future for The Technologizer, Harry?
So right now I'm kind of in soft launch mode because I've been posting at a fairly rapid clip, but I need a lot more content to get people to come. So you'll see me do a lot more reviews. I'd say the key kind of content I'll have in the future are product reviews, which are pretty meaty, but are not aimed at total hardcore geeks. I want to reach out to the mainstream a little more. So you'll see me do a lot of reviews, which I'm just getting rolling on. I launched something just today called the T-List, which is sort of a little news roundup, which I'll do every day. You'll also see other contributors come on board because I don't want to be limited by the fact there's only one of me and there's only so much writing I can do. And I think you guys are right. I think I should try things like podcasts and video and other media as well, because I can do all of those things today.
You can, and obviously not everyone should, but I think you definitely should. I think you've got a lot to bring to this technology world we live in. Everything seems to be going tech crazy right now. Every news broadcast that I see, we always hear a .com at the end of a company's name. For more on this story, go to blankblankblank.com. So everybody is online now. And I think that there's too many gadget websites out there that are all kind of regurgitating the latest press release. So I'm curious, are you going to stay away from those press release type of stories, and you're going to stick with more of original content?
I really want as much as possible to do stuff that has a hands-on element. I mean, I love sites like Gizmodo and Engadget that do tech news, but the world doesn't need another site of that type. So
we need people that are actually using these products and telling us if they're worthwhile.
I will do reviews. I will try to touch stuff as much as possible. I will give you my opinion, whether it's good or bad. The other thing which I really want to concentrate on is the community aspect. And right now at Technologizer, you can sign up to be a community member, and we have forums and user groups, and you can post photos and videos. And I'd like to see that grow and grow, because ultimately, for almost anything I know anything about, I'm going to have people who read Technologizer who know more than I do, and I want to give them the tools to contribute.
Who else is working with you on Technologizer? Is it pretty much a one-man show right now?
In terms of content, it's basically me. I'm working with a company called Federated Media on the advertising side, because the one thing I would be completely incompetent to do is sell advertising, and that would be a conflict of interest if I was doing that too. And Federated Media is a company where the one thing they do is to sell advertising on blogs, and they work with TechCrunch and a bunch of other well-known sites, and they will be doing the advertising side of things for me.
Are you interested in partnering up with some of these other technology websites out there, or are you just going to you're going to be an island unto yourself?
I think that will make sense, because I can't cover everything. And rather than doing everything poorly, it makes sense for me to focus in on some things that I do well. And so I think you will see me working with other sites. I'm also, by the way, still a contributing editor to PC World. You'll see my byline pop up there.
So any other websites that you're involved with right now?
That's mostly it. I think I will do some writing for other folks. I write from time to time about technology for Slate, which is one of my favorite websites, so I really like showing up there as well.
Are you surprised Slate's still around? I was surprised after they got bought out years and years and years ago. Were they bought out or were they actually started then?
They were actually started by Microsoft.
They were started by Microsoft. That's what I thought.
And
I think it's one of the greatest things Microsoft ever invented.
I just love Slate. I always say it's one of my favorite Microsoft products.
It's a great one.
And Microsoft actually sold it to the Washington Post a few years ago, which kind of makes sense. And my guess says it probably has a much brighter future being part of the Post since it's so closely aligned with what they do.
Yeah, but where do you see traditional media in the future, Harry? Do you think that magazines like PC World are in trouble with more and more people going to sites like yours to get their tech news and it's up to date and it's today and it's not necessarily a month or 6 weeks out of date by the time they get a magazine? Or do you think that they're going to be fine?
Well, the world is changing rapidly, and companies like PC World, the thing that PC World has to do and actually has been doing quite successfully is not to be a magazine company that has a website, but to flip that around and make the website as strong as it can be and also publish a really good magazine. But the website needs to be the dog and the magazine needs to be the tail. And if you look at PC World today, most of the people who come to PC World today are coming to the website, and we spend a lot of time making sure that we were creating content that people liked on the web, and having a presentation that made sense and giving people community tools so they could interact with that content. So I think a lot of brands will thrive forever, and I'm sure there will come a day when PC World is only online, and that might be okay. Because really, if you run a media company, it's really your readers who decide where you go and what you do.
Yes, absolutely.
And because, by definition, people who read about technology are comfortable with this stuff, they are going online. And even though I think PC World will have a magazine for quite a while, ultimately the writing is on the wall, and you've got to serve people where they want to be served.
If somebody is interested in becoming a writer in the tech world, what would your suggestions to them be? How will they get started?
You know, I think the key thing I've always advised writers as the first thing you need to do is write for an audience, whether you get paid, whether you have a lot of readers or just a few. So if I was getting going today, I would just start up a blog and begin to write and get some experience and have some clips. I think there are a lot of websites, including mine for that matter, that might be interested in talking to people who want to write. But I think the main thing is just to get the hand of writing.
Yep.
And worry about the money later. When I started writing, I self-published a magazine I made no money on. If I made $20 for something I wrote, I'd be thrilled. And that's how I got the experience to do things that I could do full time.
Harry, given that you've got some fame on the internet for taking a principled stand in terms of the work you do, as opposed to the business side of things, do you think it's important for a writer to receive editorial input as they develop themselves as a writer, so that they learn the tricks of objectivity and managing your own internal bias and that sort of thing? Because my view is that there are an awful lot of writers on the web who are blogging and their stuff is even though they're not aware of it, they are presenting editorial content because they're presenting their opinions as opposed to an objective view. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, the best thing about blogs is they're unfiltered, and the worst thing about blogs is they're unfiltered.
Yeah.
Though I'm doing something now where I'm editing myself, if I do well at that, I think that's partially because I have this traditional experience, and I spent a lot of time writing things that were edited by people who taught me an awful lot about thinking about what I was saying. And, if you're going to have biases, admit it and be upfront about it. And if you're trying to be objective, you really have to get your head around things and realize that your background may influence what you think. And I think even people who are completely ethical about their content sometimes, would find value from having somebody else provide some opinion about it. Of course, the good thing about the web today is even if you don't have an editor editing you, essentially your readers are editing you.
Yep.
Because you will get comments, you will get feedback, you will get email. And you'll hear from people in great volume.
Who's your favorite writer right now, tech or otherwise? Or, anybody, who's your favorite writers out there?
You know, in terms of tech, again, I'm coming back to Slate a little bit. I think they publish some good stuff. There's a guy named Paul Boutin who has written a lot from Slate, who I've learned from and think is
very good writer,
very smart. He's also become a friend of mine. I think both Engadget and Gizmodo are still doing good stuff, even though they're so much bigger than they used to be. I've learned from both of them. I will continue to learn from some of the people who write for PC World. One of my mentors is a guy named Dan Tynan, who does a lot of writing for publications like PC World and InfoWorld, and is really smart and good at what he does.
How about non-tech?
Non-tech, I love politics, so I'm having a lot of fun this year reading political blogs and blogs like Kaus Files and Andrew Sullivan. I come back to a lot. Instapundit, sites like those are having an awful lot of fun. And I think even technology writers can learn from the way they do their reporting and engage the community.
I think it's almost the same kind of type of writers in a way. I mean, one's about tech, one's about politics, but they seem to be a lot of interconnected content goes between politics and tech nowadays, I think.
Absolutely, and I think there are certain things about writing for the web that are consistent no matter what your topic is. And it's quite different from the days when I started in this business where you'd work for a monthly magazine and it was completely normal to work on something for 3 or 4 months and to polish it and make it perfect. And then you'd put it out there in a magazine, and if there was anything wrong with it, it was terrible because you could change it.
Now, your sister's a writer too, correct?
She is. She actually, I've always been amazed by the fact that because she writes books, she's not writing for 3 or 4 months. She's sometimes writing for 3 or 4 years, and things are and books are even more permanent than magazines are.
Definitely.
We are kind of a writing family, and she's a novelist, and she actually has a nonfiction book coming out soon.
Now, did your parents write too?
You know, my parents are both writers too. My mother is a magazine editor. She works for Boston University, and my father, until he retired, was a speechwriter and actually did quite a bit of magazine writing on the side when I was growing up, which is probably one of the things that got me interested in this.
So this is in your blood.
I think so. I mean, we like to communicate. My father was also was a gadget nerd, which probably had a big impact on me getting interested in PCs. And like a lot of people, when I was in high school, he brought a computer home one day, and that's how I got excited by it.
And that was your first computer?
It was a TRS-80. This was 1978.
Mm-hmm.
I was 14. And so I guess this is my 30th year of being into this stuff.
TRS-80 was my first one as well, at least the first one that I got to play with often. I was 8 years old when it came out in 1978, and I have very fond memories of the TRS-80.
The first computer I bought with my own money was an Atari. I became an Amiga fanatic for a while.
Who didn't back in the day?
I was a Amiga fan. Yeah.
When you look back then, go ahead.
I was a Mac snob before I used Windows. I started using Windows partially because I got a job at a magazine that covered Windows. And so then for a while, for a few years, I used Windows because that's what everybody did. And then 3 or 4 years ago, I sort of had an epiphany that I could use a Mac again. And you didn't have to choose between Mac and Windows. So I've kind of become agnostic on platforms because I've used all of them. And I basically feel today that you should use whatever the best tool is for the job in question. And that will vary depending on who you are and what you're doing.
I usually ask this of all of our guests, and I know we're running a little bit later than I had planned. I wanted to let you out of here sooner, Siri. Sorry for keeping you so long. But I did want to ask you this question. Excluding the current computers you own, what was your favorite computer of all time? I know it's a difficult one to answer sometimes. It's like, oh, wow, I got to think.
It would come down to either the Amiga or the TRS-80. I mean, the Amiga was an amazingly highly evolved machine for its time in terms of graphics and multimedia, but I think if I had to choose one, it would be the TRS-80, and partially because it was the first one I used, but it's also the computer I knew best. Computers were so simple in those days. You could kind of understand everything there was to know about a computer, and I could program it in machine language. I could write games that were as good as almost anybody's games from scratch for it myself. It's kind of like having a Model T, which was such a simple car that if you owned one, you could probably fix it yourself. And as much better as computers are today, I feel like my knowledge of them is a lot more limited. And in fact, there's nobody on earth who knows everything there is to know about something like a MacBook Pro today. So I think that the TRS-80 is the machine I knew best, and for that reason, it's the one I'm probably still fondest of.
I found that there's a lack of history with all these tech websites, that very, very, very few websites out there kind of touch upon the history of the computer industry. Do you have any plans on covering that kind of a category as a technologizer? Jeez, I still can't say it, can I? Technologizer.
I absolutely do. One of the fun things we learned at PC World is some of the most successful stories that we ever did were about the history of computing. And I love to write about the history of computers, and I think people love to think about the technology devices in their life. So you will definitely see some of that stuff from me.
Ars Technica had a big history on, what computer company was it? I forget now. Oh, Commodore. And the last time I checked, it was up to 4 parts. And each part was like 6 or 7 pages, and it was fantastic. They were going through the entire history of the company from when Jack Tramiel took it over, and it was just a fascinating read. And I would really like to see more of that. So if you do that, I'm going to be back quite often, because I think that the history of the computer industry, which is pretty all-encompassing. I mean, nowadays you can even put the, you know, like we were talking about earlier, media companies and everything else in there. I just don't think that the current crop of new users are really, really well-versed on the history of the computer industry. And I think it's a fascinating industry to talk about.
Thinking of people I've met, actually, Jack Tramiel, I just met a few months ago. We have the Computer History Museum out here, and they had an event that they brought him into. And he was such an important person with the Commodore 64 and the PET back in the 80s. He was really one of the people who made computers affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And he did some of that stuff at Atari as well. And then he kind of disappeared for about 15 to 20 years.
What is he doing now?
He's retired. As far as I know, he's out of the business, but he's still a pretty engaging personality.
He's in his 70s now, correct?
I think. Probably. Maybe even 80s. He had vanished so entirely that I wasn't really sure what happened to him. And it was nice to see him up on a stage getting some credit for all the important things he did.
Was he as grouchy as he comes across in some of the old stories?
A little bit. I mean, he was sort of cranky in a cheerful and an engaging way.
I always kind of pictured him as kind of a John Dvorak.
I mean, I think he was sort of the anti-Steve Jobs, in that he was sort of a big balding guy in a suit smoking a cigar, and he didn't care too much about aesthetics. Commodore 64 is still one of the most widely sold computers there ever was, and that was an awful lot of people's first machines. And
he bought Atari too.
Yeah, he didn't have as much good luck with Atari, but he also did some interesting stuff there. And if you were going to name probably the 5 most important people there ever were in terms of the business of personal computing, he would certainly be on that list.
Well, see, now there's a nice article for you right there. The 5 most important people in the technology history.
I may well do that.
Obviously, Bill Gates would have to be number 1. I mean, whether you like Microsoft or not, and I don't, it's a company I have no feelings one way or another, but what Bill Gates did in the computer industry is he is Henry Ford of the computer industry. At least that's the way I kind of look at the guy. But then again, maybe Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak is in that role as well. And then I was just going to say, what about the Packards?
We actually did a story naming the most important people at PC World, and in the end, the people we named as number 1 were the guys who invented the integrated circuit,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, I don't even remember what their names are off the top of my head myself, but we kind of decided that without the integrated circuit, none of these devices would
that's
have
right.
existed, and nobody ever would have heard of Steve Jobs or Bill Gates.
Yeah, but that's kind of a product, though, that would have been invented regardless of who did it eventually, don't you agree? I mean, it's almost a natural evolution of technology. I mean, yes, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak started Apple, and Apple created the Macintosh, and Apple created the iPhone, but these things would have happened eventually without those companies, I think. Maybe it would have happened a lot later, and maybe it would have been even better than what we know
now
to have happened, but it would have happened eventually.
it's fun to wonder. I mean, it's cool to ask yourselves questions like, what if Apple never existed, or what if Apple, instead of just struggling in the mid-90s, had actually gone out of business? What if there had never been an iPod? Would Sony have invented the iPod?
Well, Rio was already out there, though.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people forget that the MP3s existed before Apple. Apple just got the software and the hardware
to work together.
Yeah. In fact, almost everything Apple has ever done, they're almost never first with anything, but they're often first to sort of make a product
make it
sense
mainstream.
In way. Yeah.
Yeah, and make it cool. Well, Harry, we want to thank you for being on the show this week, and we want to invite all of our listeners out there to check out the Technologizer. I'll put a link on the website. It is TECHNOLOGIZER. I know everyone just wrote that on the dust on their dashboards.
Just go to the site and click the link.
Just click the link. But thanks a lot, Harry. We really appreciate it. It's fascinating talking to you, and we wish you all the success in the future.
Thanks so much, guys.
We'll be right back. And we're back. That was great talking with Harry. I've never met him in person, and that was the first time I actually talked to him via email, but what a great guest. I mean, the guy's been around for a long time.
Very, very knowledgeable. And yep. It was, I've heard him quite a few times on other podcasts as well.
But none of the other podcasts ever really go into who he is and, do an interview. He's more of a guest host on other shows, like Twitch.
Don't you find it interesting as well that everyone assumed that when the article was written, 10 Things We Hate About Apple, that, oh, he's the editor of PC World and he hates Apple and all that sort of thing. And it turns out 4 or 5 years he'd been using Macs.
Yeah, yep. No, I'm not surprised, though. At least after hearing him talk, I'm not surprised. Very, very nice guy. I wish him all the success with that website. I've got a bookmark myself. It's going to be one of those sites that I visit once a day, at least. Go up there first thing in the morning when I bring up the MacBook Pro in the kitchen and kind of go through all my news sites. I've got 10 or 11 of them that I check first thing in the morning, see what's new, see what was posted yesterday. And that's definitely going to make the list. So I think that he's going to be number 12 on that list now.
Absolutely. There's a great article on there about Microsoft campaigns trying to improve the image of Windows Vista, which echoes many of the things we were talking about last week about Microsoft.
Yeah. He's also got one about what Ms. Pac-Man could teach Hasbro about Scrabulous. Something very similar happened years and years and years ago, where some outside company kind of made a clone or kind of made a upgrade to the Pac-Man game, and it was Ms. Pac-Man, and it wasn't the company, it wasn't Namco who did it. And instead of simply crushing them, Namco just bought them and made what they did into Ms. Pac-Man. Yeah. Unlike what Hasbro just did, which is close this Scrabulous down.
A popular game that a lot of people really, really loved and might have actually paid money for, and just shut it down.
Well, they've been discussing it. They've been in contact for almost a half a year now, guys. So I think it goes a little deeper than that. I think these guys wanted a lot more than Hasbro is willing to give them. And, at the end of the day, Hasbro owns the rights to it. And somebody else that comes out and makes a complete clone, same rules, same game board, same everything, they gotta protect their intellectual property.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't blame them. But I think these other people, and I don't know their story, obviously, but, you gotta watch out for that kind of thing. So, anyways, let's talk a little bit about our sponsor right now. Guy, you picked something from Otherworld Computing this week to chat about briefly?
Yeah, the ITV Hybrid from Elgato. It's
a two-in-one
TV for your Mac. And it looks like it really, really does some really cool things. Number one, it's also made for the Mac, which helps.
Yes.
But you can connect your game consoles. You can navigate with using the remote. You get really good digital TV recordings. And, it's at a price where if you watch TV on your computer, $67.99.
I used one of the earlier versions of this, the ITV Hybrid, and I really liked it. It was great. Now, of course, the difference between me watching television on my computer and simply walking 2 feet and watching it on my HDTV didn't really make a lot of sense. So I didn't use it a whole lot, but from what I did for my review, the picture was really good. I was surprised. Plus, it allowed you to set up schedules. It would act kind of like a DVR. You can record your shows. You can bring those files into GarageBand and, or I'm sorry, into iMovie and edit them. It's a very powerful piece of hardware, and it's really small too. It's about the size of the Apple remote.
Well, yeah. It sounds like if you're using a Mac Mini as your kind of digital hub in entertainment system, this is just made for it.
Yep. Yeah. And it's less than $70 at MacSales.com.
And, it works with almost any Mac, PowerPC, G4, G5, Intel.
Yep.
Yeah, the thing as well is because it's hybrid, so it's got analog as well as digital, that means you can use it to connect up a VCR or an analog camera and transfer that old analog content into your Mac so you can edit it as well. So yeah. You're really getting a lot of features for the money here.
Yeah, if you've got old family videos that's still on VHS and that's the only place you have them, something like this is really going to save your bacon when that tape starts to deteriorate in another 10 to 15 years. Get it on your computer, burn it to a DVD, right. and get it saved. You know, don't burn just one copy of it, burn two, and then take the second copy to someone else's house. So in case your house burns down, your old movies are saved.
God forbid.
But it does happen, so. The Elgato iTV Hybrid, check it out at MacSales.com. We will have a link directly from show 194 up at MyMac.com. Thanks for picking that one this week, Guy.
Oh, sure.
And thank you, Otherworld Computing, for sponsoring the podcast and the website.
Yes.
So, a lot of, not a lot of news, but one of the news stories this week is cracks in the iPhone. Some users are reporting cracks in the new G3 iPhones in both the white and the black models. Users report that the hairline fractures are often appearing on the black plastic shell near the corners of the device, particularly near the headphone jack. What do you guys think? Think this is going to be a big issue?
Well, I guess the real problem here is that Apple's really gotten kind of a black eye lately with the 3G iPhone launch, and this is really the last thing they need. They need to get a handle on this and get a handle on it quickly.
Don't you think they probably will, though?
I think we just lost David.
Yep.
This isn't really the first time that something like this has happened, and Apple occasionally has a history of kind of following if we ignore it will go away method of management of an issue like this, and I'm hoping now obviously I don't have a 3G iPhone or an iPhone period, but if I had just spent $199 and had a 24-month contract, you know, with AT&T or whoever your provider is, I would want that thing to be perfect right out of the gate.
Yeah, but it never is, though. I mean, well, sometimes it is, but very, very rarely is a new product launched without at least some problems. And
right.
I think Apple's probably going to be very proactive on getting this thing corrected. I think if you have a crack on your iPhone 3G and you take it to Apple, they're going to take care of you. You think David?
Yeah, I mean, the phones are obviously still on warranty. I mean, the first thing I did when I read this is I immediately pulled the case off mine and gave it a good old look, but it seems okay at the moment. So, I mean, they were shipping so many units so quickly, it's possible that there's a few that had a bad plastic mix or something and are showing this. I would hope it's not a problem that's affecting every single unit.
Now, Geisero, you're the one that usually comes up with our news that we're going to cover during the week, and one of them is Steve Jobs' health still in question? We're going to skip that one because, you know, personally, I don't think it's any of our business on what his health is.
Right.
And I don't think Apple's continued existence is necessarily completely dependent upon Steve Jobs. I think that he's a smart guy and he set up that company. But, you know, his health is
It's definitely a private issue. You know, just my whole take on it was it seems like you're hearing a lot of reports on how this is affecting Apple's stock price. And honestly, you know, does anyone really believe that if you know, God forbid, Steve Jobs dropped dead tomorrow, that Apple would just fall off the face of the earth?
No, but, you know, when it comes to the stock market, though, a fly farting on an elephant's ass in Africa can affect the stock market. So, I mean, you know.
Microsoft stock.
Yeah, it's because of the stock market, because that's the main culprit on high gas prices right now. A lot of people want to say it's because of the greed of the oil industry. It has nothing to do with the oil industry.
Speculators.
Exactly, in the stock market, that's where the problem is. So,
and Apple's stock is not subject to the same sort of common sense rules that, you know, more ordinary blue chip stocks like IBM or something is, you know, related to. They released the best quarterly results they ever did, and the stock immediately took a nosedive.
Yeah, go figure.
You know, you can't relate anything that happens around Apple directly with the stock price and what happens to the stock.
With Apple, you buy on rumor, I guess sell on news.
SciStar, the Mac clone maker, illegal Mac clone maker, according to Apple, is going to fight back, Guy Searle.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. Court records show that SciStar has retained for its defense a high-profile Silicon Valley law firm that's previously tangled with Apple in one. It's a sign that despite its small size, it intends to see to the conclusion a case that could have a profound impact on the personal computer industry. Defending them will be attorneys from a Palo Alto-based Carr and Farrell, which employs more than two dozen lawyers specializing in tech industry issues.
Well, and, you know, we're going to follow this till it's to the end.
Sure.
If we're still around in, you know, 12 years by the time this gets away through court. I personally think, though, that SciStar will fold fairly quickly. I just don't think they have the deep pockets to fight Apple.
Well, I mean, the law firm concerned may be doing it for, you know, on a no-win-no-fee basis.
Yeah.
You know, I suspect actually probably what will happen is there'll be a settlement.
Yep.
If they, you know, presumably this law firm thinks they have some sort of case to answer. So Apple will probably settle it for, you know, a few million part of the deal for that will be that SciStar will take their portion of the money after the legal fees have been taken away, and will shut up shop. So that will probably be the end of it, I'd imagine.
I got a new game shipped to me from Feral Interactive this week. It's called Battle Stations Midway, and I had a chance to play it for about a half hour so far, so it's way too quick to give any kind of an informed review or anything. But so far it's not bad, but it seemed a little twitchy. It was kind of hard to control, but I like the premise of the game.
What platform is this for the Mac?
This is for the Mac, yep.
Okay,
I wouldn't talk about it if it was, you know, Xbox 360 game.
I thought it might be an iPhone app, that was all.
It says, take command of the greatest battles of the war, World War II, of course, in the Pacific. Experience every aspect of combat in the superb blend of action and strategy. You command the fleet, but you can also assume direct control of any unit, warship, aircraft, or submarine. So far, it's not bad. The graphics aren't bad. I did notice that the lip-syncing of the claymation-looking characters weren't spot-on, but, you know, that's kind of nitpicking. But it was kind of hard to control. I couldn't really wrap my head around how to do certain things that I was supposed to do in the game. Shooting down the planes wasn't too hard, but I'm trying to steer the ship and aim with my mouse and shoot things at the same time. Maybe I'm just not that skilled anymore, but... you know, I meant to, you know, slowly go up and aim right at an aircraft, and my mouse is, or the, you know, the cursor on my screen is going all over the place. It was very, very hard to control.
So what happens with this? If I mean, looking at the website, it looks like you can control pretty much anything you want. So if you jump into a plane and start dive bombing a carrier, what happens to the rest of the battle? Does your
guess is as good as mine? I only started the game, and the only thing I've had to do so far was control this little patrol boat trying to go after Japanese fighter planes and a sub that's somewhere in the Pearl Harbor. So
was that the PT-109?
Yeah, I think so.
We were talking about the Amiga before with Harry. And I had a 1942 flight simulator game for the Amiga that I absolutely adored. I'm trying to remember, I think it was a MicroProse game that I had back in the Amiga days. So I might take a look at this because I always found that game really fun.
Now, you were talking off air, Guy, about a submarine game that you used to play in the Mac OS pre-7.0 days.
Yeah, it was a sub-battle simulator. I played it on my old Mac Plus back in, you know, 87 to 94 when I had that system, running under System 6. And it was, you know, you basically were in command of either a German U-boat or an American submarine in the Pacific. And, I mean, it was one of those games where it was really, really intense because you'd go up to the surface, fire off some torpedoes and, you know, throw off some shells from a deck gun, and then if you didn't manage to sink everything, you'd pretty much be dead because you couldn't go fast enough to get away from the other ships as they're dropping depth charges. But it was really a lot of fun. I had a blast with it. I used to play that while I was holding my son Guy when he was just a little baby.
Yeah, it's amazing how you get these memories, at least when you're our age, on the last time you played a certain game, how big the kids were or how big they weren't at the time.
Yeah. Guy was actually, you know, he used to sit in my lap, and I'd have him kind of cuddled here, and I'd be holding the bottle in him with one hand, and I'm doing the keyboard and the mouse with the other. And the thing that he used to love to watch the most was the old Simpsons screensaver, which is crack him up.
One of the things that I had talked about on this podcast a while back, and I said, you know, I wish they still had this for Mac OS X, was KeyWack. Do you guys remember me talking about KeyWack?
Yeah.
It was just a simple application that you would run. It would blank out your screen, and then your baby could literally pound the crap out of your keyboards, and it just made different shapes on the screen and made sounds like a cow mooing and a dog barking and somebody laughing, that sort of thing. And then the shapes would be, you know, like a star or a circle or that sort of thing. They actually have a version of this, and it's absolutely free. The guy who wrote it, KeyWack, has a Mac OS X version, which I found last week. I was very, very happy. So now my youngest, Cole, who's 7 months now, can play KeyWack just like my other daughters did back in the pre-OS X days. So
yeah, I was going to say, I don't think your 13-year-old daughters would be much interested in it now.
But, you know, my 14-year-old daughter used to sit on my lap when she was Cole's age and whack at my Apple extended keyboard playing KeyWack. And she could literally sit there for hours. And every time the cow mooed, she would laugh. I mean, it was just a great memory that I had. So now that I have this application, I'm very glad because it's going to be something that my son will be able to enjoy just like his oldest sister did. So something to keep in mind if you've got young ones and they like to sit on your lap when you're on the computer, but obviously you don't want them banging on the keyboard when you're trying to do something. If you want them to have some fun, KeyWack. And it's spelled...
Go ahead, sorry.
It's spelled just the way it sounds, KEWWACK. I found it on Version Tracker. Go ahead, Guy.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you going to link to that in the show notes?
I'll put a note in right now, so hopefully I will remember. KeyWack. So look for that in show 194. Some of the content up at MyMac.com right now. Guy, you did a review of the FS100 digital video camera from Canon.
Yeah, that was actually my own camera that I purchased with my own money.
Which we don't usually like to review, but that's okay.
No, I've been looking for a new video camera for a very long time, and I wanted it to be small, I wanted it to have a microphone input, and I wanted it to be full digital. And unless you're going to start going up into like the near $1,000 range, that's a really, really hard thing to find. And I saw this at an Apple store, and almost bought it right there. I'm glad I didn't because I found it elsewhere for almost $100 less.
Yeah, no big surprise there.
Yeah. Now, the only thing I really didn't like about it was the type of files that it makes. Now, it works really well with iMovie 08, but otherwise you're going to need some other types of software in order to use the video that it puts out.
You guys keep talking for a second. I have to actually answer a telephone call.
Okay.
So, well, take over the show.
All right, well, the video that I found that works with this camera is by a company called Squared 5, and the software itself is called MPEG Steam Clip, and
I use it. It's a fantastic program. It really is amazing what it can do, actually.
Yeah, and now my son Peter, my younger son Peter, for his birthday, I bought him a Vivitar flash memory video camera because he's very interested in making movies, and it was the same kind of thing. Now it would put out AVI files, which you couldn't put into iMovie, you know, raw. So we had to use this, and there was another program we used that escapes me at the moment that we used to convert the video formats into something that QuickTime would actually work with.
I use, and I'm back, by the way, is my oldest daughter. Visual Hub is what I use to convert almost any video format into a Mac-friendly one.
Yeah. Well, what's good about MPEG Stream Clip is that it actually is an editing program as well. So once you've brought the videos into it, you can actually trim bits out and save them out as QuickTime files that will then go into iMovie. So you can actually do a first pass in, you know, editing some of the stuff out. And it's a really easy editing program to use.
Is it free or is it cheap?
Yeah, it's free.
Is it free?
In fact, it's really good. If you're ever working with DVD MPEG 2, it's really good at that as well.
Well, send me an email so I can put that into the show notes and we can link to that as well.
Okay.
Some of the other content, two things right in a row from David Cohen. You did a MacBook laptop bag, and then you have a fenestration number 43. What are those two?
Well, the laptop bag is from BEEZ, who are a French laptop bag company, and I reviewed a product of theirs, the La Robe bag, earlier on the year. And this is a MacBook Pro bag. This one's for the MacBook itself, the 13-inch MacBook, and a really nice bag, actually, quite a natty design. Does have this kind of insert that pads the bag out, so it's got plenty of space in. And actually, I really liked it. It's a really nice roomy bag, and does quite a good job of protecting the MacBook. And then the other article was fenestration, and I was talking about winds of change. I was talking about SciStar and some of the projects available to actually look at putting OS X on an ordinary PC. And I also recounted there my experiences in getting OS X on a very small, cheap PC laptop called the MSI Wind.
Wow. That looks so cool. I've got the article up right now, and I'm looking at the picture of it, and I'm drooling.
Yeah, as I've been saying, it's a really cheap little laptop. Uses one of these new Intel Atom processors, very low power, little 10-inch screen, nice good sized keyboard. But really, it's kind of a different take on a sub notebook like the MacBook Air. But rather than being thin, this is just quite a bit smaller.
Now, was there anything that didn't work?
The 3.5mm audio jacks don't work on it, but you know you can live without those if you use a USB device like the Griffin iMic. You can get over that. I had to change the wireless card inside the laptop to get a wireless card that worked with OS X.
So what was the final price?
Well, let's see. I paid £280 for the laptop, so that's $550, something like that. And then it was about $20 for the wireless card. And obviously a copy of Leopard to put on as well.
So for about the price of a Mac Mini, you've got this small, beautiful little PC that's running OS X with a 10-inch screen.
Exactly. And it runs, it's not the fastest machine in the world. It's only a single core processor. But, it runs perfectly fine and runs VMware Fusion as well, so I can bring up Windows programs if I need to. Does the job. It's a very nice little machine.
Are you going to bring that to Macworld next year?
Well, yes, because when I'm sat in the press room, I don't want to be hanging my head in shame with a Windows PC again. So I will be planning, provided I can get reassurances that the Apple stormtroopers won't come and take me away for running it.
We'll
run interference. Just tell them that you know somebody that's a second degree black belt.
And who's like 6'7".
Yeah. It is interesting. These little cheap laptops have really taken the PC market by storm. And it will be, there's all these rumors swirling around now that Apple's got new products on the way. I noticed actually either today or yesterday that they were sending letters out to dealers saying to stock up on MacBook and MacBook Pros.
And iPad.
Because they'll last them over the next 4 weeks, which is normally an indication that there's new products on the way. I was actually browsing the Apple refurb store this morning, and I noticed that pretty much every model of MacBook and MacBook Pro is actually listed on there. Most of them aren't available for sale, but they've actually listed every single model on there, which I think that they're going to be clearing a lot of stock out very shortly. So I think we're going to get some new machines, and I would love it if they actually looked at these cheap netbook-type computers and did an Apple version of that. I would happily pay double what I paid for this machine to have an official Apple version in a nice, sexy Jonathan Ive case.
Is there anything that the MSI Wind has or doesn't have that you think Apple would do better other than that audio jack?
No, I mean it's pretty fully featured. You've got, it's better featured in some ways than the MacBook Air. I mean, it has three USB ports, it has an 80 gig drive, has the 1.6 gigahertz processor in, it's got a gig of memory. This Intel Atom platform is very, very low power, only runs about 7 watts, so the machine doesn't heat up at all when you're using it. Unless Unless they're obsessed with retaining the large screen and large keyboard, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't go to this platform for a low power Mac. The only problem is it's so good it might cannibalize some of the higher end of the range.
Yeah, but I think Apple would rather cannibalize their own sale than somebody else cannibalize it for them.
For them, yeah.
Yeah, so I think a machine like this at $1,000, they would not be able to sell them quick enough.
Some of the other content up at mymac.com right now is a Kinston keyboard review from Russ Walkowicz, the CI70. That's kind of a neat-looking keyboard. Two book reviews from Neil Monks, The Missing Manual versus My New Mac, Missing Manual for Mac OS X Leopard. Scott has a review of Storyist, which... looks interesting. It might be something that I would have to look at in the future for my writing. And finally, David Weeks has a review of the HP PhotoSmart C8180 all-in-one printer. So that's the latest happenings up at mymac.com, at least on the feature side. We've got a lot of blog posts, of course. A couple from Guy, who's basically pointing to Mac Hippie.
Yeah. My ever-so-serious Mac Hippie poll.
Downey Yankelo has a couple of issues with the App Store, and it's issues that I am having as well, so read that, please. And Bill Palmer talks about his earthquake experience. Interesting. We don't have to worry about that here in Michigan. I've never experienced an earthquake, and I hope I never do.
Now, the only thing we have to worry about here in Washington, D.C. is hot air.
Hot air, and you get a lot of that in the Washington, D.C. area, absolutely.
Yes.
Anything else that we need to touch on before we wrap it up, guys?
Silence. So.
Silence greets me. So that means we're going to silence the podcast now. David Cohen, thank you very much for being on the show this week.
Always a pleasure.
Guy Searle, thank you.
I love it. Oh, I would like to mention one thing.
Sure.
This weekend I'm taking my wife and kids to Williamsburg for her birthday. And I'd just like to say happy birthday, Tracy.
There you go. Happy birthday, Tracy. What a nice
happy
husband. Thanks again to Harry McCracken for being on this show this week's show, if I could speak right. It was great to meet him, and I hope to hear more from Harry in the future with his own podcast, if he ever does it. And, of course, I'm going to be looking at his website quite often.
Great site.
Yeah, it really is a great site. I like it a lot. Now, obviously, we didn't have Sam Levin this week. He'll be back next week, but it's going to be a little bit different from Sam Levin next week because he's going to be at the iPhone Developers Conference, and he's going to be sending in some interviews and reports from the showroom floor. So I'm really looking forward to finding out what Sam's got going, and could be interesting. And I know for a fact... But Sam's got some stuff to give away next week. Giveaway time. But I'm not going to say who the product is yet. So, anyways, my name is Tim Robertson. I publish MyMac.com, and I will see you next week.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to mymacpodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the mymac.com podcast.